Hello, this is the trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch the full hour-long version with all my guest tracks in full, do listen in to RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest this week is visually impaired Liverpudlian comedian and actor Chris McCausland, who you may have seen as a guest on many radio and TV panel shows recently. And Chris also performed on stage at last year's Royal Variety Performance at the Royal Albert Hall. Hello, Chris, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
How are you doing? It's good to be here.
I'm well, Chris. We obviously are going to come to your first track in a moment, but I wanted to first ask how you found it just selecting seven tracks, and do you think any of your chosen tracks might be good for going out on stage to, say, maybe live at the Apollo?
Have you ever had anyone on here that said it was easy? That's the first question. it's hard for a lot of reasons. It's hard to narrow it down. It's hard to then separate the tracks that you just really, really like from tracks that kind of represent different parts of your life. Then you've got to get rid of the ones that have got naughty words in them, because these days I think about 85% of songs seem to be non-broadcastable on the radio, especially the genres that I tend to listen to. And then what I've had to do is I've had to kind of avoid the genres that I think might make your listeners' ears bleed.
Well, your first track, Chris, is The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News, and it was very much featured heavily in the Back to the Future trilogy of films, which even inspired the band McFly. And I wondered what sort of hooked you into those films first, and, you know, sort of at that time, were you able to see what was going on the big screen or the small screen?
I just love Back to the Future. It represents everything about films in the 80s in their best possible light. It reminds me of being a kid. I don't know when I watched the first film. I mean, I would have been, it came out in 85 and I would have been 8. So I don't know whether I watched, I don't remember going to the cinema for it. I must have watched it on video or something like that. But I remember going to the cinema for the second and third ones. And It was just the best trilogy of films that I remember watching for the first time, and even now I kind of revisit them. But everything about them just still kind of, you know, has that real nostalgic feel for me. I love revisiting them. It inspired a love of all things time related, really. Whether it kind of be, you know, getting into Stephen Hawking stuff and learning a lot more about physics and quantum gobbledygook, and also a certain type of sci-fi. Now, I only kind of realized this more recently, but I have a real love for a very particular type of sci-fi that is kind of mad things happening. To see, like, whatever's happening in the story is just as mad to the person in the story as it is to you watching it. And you can take your kind of fantasy worlds and your empires and your gods of war, and I haven't got time for any of that kind of fantasy nonsense. But when you've got a story about somebody normal in a contemporary world and something crazy happens to them and they find it just as mad as you do watching it, that's my type of sci-fi. And when I was thinking about this, I had a lot of time over lockdown kind of listening to a lot more audiobooks than I usually get time for and things. And I realized that it probably all goes back to the Future. This mad thing happening to this kid in a time traveling DeLorean. I think the ripple effects of that film still influence me tastes today, really. But this song is uplifting, it's fun, it's catchy, and it just brings back good memories, you know.
Power Power of Love there by Huey Lewis and the News, and memories of the Back to the Future films for you, Chris. Now we come to your first vinyl album, and the one that you brought back when you were 11 at school in Worcester, and one which I think you may have been influenced by other older children at the time. But for the kids out there who may not have had this experience like some of us had of having to go to a shop and buy an album and wait and pick it up and everything else, what was that feeling like when you did have to go to the shop and pick up the album and bring it home and play it for the first time?
Well, I when I was in Worcester College, before I went to Worcester, I think for my 10th birthday, I got this little double cassette ghetto blaster. And I remember when I got it, I got, now that's what I call Music 10 on tape with it that Christmas. So I can kind of pinpoint it's weird with these Now albums. You can kind of pinpoint exactly when songs came out based on what Now album you remember them being on and where you were in school at the time. And I think kids are going to lose that ability, aren't they, in the future without that catalogue of three times yearly album releases to kind of put these memories to. But I had this ghetto blaster. I went to Worcester College, and then when I got there, all the kids had the souped up hi-fi systems, and I remember really, really wanting one. And I saved up me pennies and maybe some birthday money and Christmas money, and I got this hi-fi system with a record player on the top by a make called Schneider that I had never heard of before and I've never heard of since. I think I bought it purely on the basis of its colossal size. It was humongous, but I think if I remember back, it was about £90, which even back then was I think it was size over quality. But I bought the album Trash by Alice Cooper, and I bought it because of the song Poison and because of the album cover. And if I remember rightly, it was just him with his hair over his face slightly with this kind of mad, colourful design T-shirt and a leather jacket over the top. And I just really, really liked the look of it. And I played it to death. It's got so many good songs on it. And it's cheesy pop metal, maybe, before it turned dark. I mean, Alice Cooper was almost like the predecessor to Marilyn Manson in a way, except Alice Cooper recognised that it was a character he played on stage, and he was just a normal fella off stage, where I think Marilyn Manson believed he was the son of the Antichrist. I think it was kind of my first footstep into that kind of music, the kind of darker guitar based metal, really. And I was surrounded by kids who were, you know, up to 16, 17 there, and I was borrowing tapes off them of bands like Skid Row, who people might remember from that kind of era, and Poison, and a lot of hair metal. And I'd like to say that this started me off down a path of being really, really quite cool with music, but I did take several steps back along the way. I mean, I was into Vanilla Ice at one point. I remember buying a Paula Abdul single. So, I did have a few missteps along the way, but Trash by Alice Cooper, I've still got it here. It still plays without skips. I have no idea how, because it was grossly mistreated by an 11 and 12-year-old. I've still got it. I've got a brand new copy as well, which is a lot cleaner and crisper and deeper, but it's just a brilliant, brilliant album still.
The rock god there, Alice Cooper and Poison, and maybe a track to headbang along to too. Now we are going to be taken back to the time of those sort of MTV Unplugged albums, which are very sort of iconic and really sort of a big thing back in the sort of mid to late 90s. Was MTV a big thing for you back then? As I think for me, it was the only way I could actually go and see the music videos of my favourite bands.
Well, at the time when this came out, 1990, late 93 maybe, when it was on MTV, I didn't have MTV. I at this time, I had long hair, and my mum and dad were using MTV and cable television as almost like a bartering tool for me to get me hair cut. If you get your hair cut, we'll get cable. And I... I'm glad to say that I was wise enough to figure out that it was actually me dad that also wanted cable. So I stuck to me guns. I let me carry on growing and we ended up getting cable. But when this came out, Nirvana, MTV Unplugged, it was a bloke in our street who, because you know, growing up in Liverpool in the 80s and 90s, it was such a community. Everyone knew each other in the streets, and you know, you could just say to a fella that you knew in the road, "Have you got Sky? Could you record this for me if I give you a tape?" But I was a huge fan of this grunge kind of movement in music in the 90s. So it started with Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all these bands. I was very much into the American side of the rock music rather than the British Britpop explosion. Couldn't stand any of that. And Nirvana, MTV Unplugged, I think now I'm older especially, is an album that... I think it represents a lot of, well, first of all, it's like a comfort blanket for me, I think. I put it on, it's relaxing, it's calming, but I think it's also inspiring. It's a band that were at the peak of their powers, so much so that, you know, the lead singer found it difficult to cope with. And so much so known for being a loud, distorted electric rock band, and didn't just do an MTV Unplugged like a lot of bands did and play an acoustic set of these loud rock songs. They completely changed what they were about, and they played a lot of songs that, you know, the MTV generation wouldn't have known. You know, B-sides, they were told that they needed to get a famous person in to do to be the guest musician with them, and they didn't. They got a band that no one had ever heard of called the Meat Puppets and played three songs by this obscure band. They did, you know, covers. They did a cover song of David Bowie, which is probably better than the original version, and a cover song of a Lead Belly song from the 1930s or something. They went against everything that they were asked to do by MTV in the face of, we want to create this, MTV wanting to create this kind of Nirvana explosive MTV extravaganza. They went against all of that and were right in every decision by creating probably what is one of the finest of the Unplugged sessions. And this song, All Apologies, would go on to be one of their big songs, but at the time when they played it, no one had heard it. I don't even think the album had been out, or maybe it had just come out. And I think it kind of says a lot about it, you know, I think where he was at the time, Kurt Cobain, but also it just represents the album really, really well. I still love listening to it. I've got this on vinyl as well. I'm a big vinyl fan. I love vinyl. I love holding it, giving it a physical quality and having to listen to things in the order they were intended rather than listening to 10 seconds or something and skipping through it because you can with your voice on a speaker.
Yeah, don't get me started on Gatefield sleeves and CDs and stuff. Yeah, don't like this always download, not owning stuff. Is it probably a sort of an understatement to say that Nirvana had a big impression on you back then?
Huge, yeah. I mean, obviously the, you know, it was all teenage angst, wasn't it? And they were primarily responsible for getting me into all kinds of other music, all other American music, and probably, you know, kickstarting my entire next 20 years of going out. And you know, I the amount of concerts I've been to living in London, just hundreds of them, and all probably stemmed from that first Nirvana album that I got, Nevermind.
Nirvana there, and I don't think I can really say much more apart from they were a real blast and really influenced a lot of musicians and bands today too as well. Now we come to a track by Pearl Jam, Chris, which I think means a lot to you in many ways, not only because they are your favourite band, but one of their tracks you proposed to your wife to at a concert of theirs in Hyde Park. Before we talk a bit about the track, how did you and your wife first meet then?
Me and my wife first met, I was doing comedy. She was a TV producer, so she was working for Sky up at the Edinburgh Festival, doing some filming up there, and we met just up there, knocking around of an evening, and she was filming me for part of what she was doing, and then when the Edinburgh Festival finished, we met up, and that was coming up to 17 years ago, coming up to. And so, but she doesn't do TV stuff now. She's a psychologist. She wanted to make documentaries that, you know, social impact documentaries that change the world about real people. And she ended up filming some chavvy scouser doing comedy. But we, as I say, Pearl Jam, part of that kind of Nirvana Seattle scene, the Seattle grunge explosion. Completely different band to Nirvana. It's weird if people are interested in the kind of music of it. It's weird how things get wrapped up together into a genre, you know, grunge. It doesn't really mean anything. It just means bands that came from Seattle in the mid-80s to mid-90s, really. But they all came from completely different influences. So if you've, you know, Nirvana came from very much a garage punk background. Pearl Jam were very much influenced by bands like the Who, you know, a lot more of a melodic 60s rock sound, and bands like Soundgarden, who your listeners might have heard of, but yet all wrapped up in this kind of grunge bubble. And in a way, it's a good thing because it means I got to find all these other different bands. And Pearl Jam became my favorite band of all. And I've seen them more times than I can imagine. And this song, Black, is off their first album. And it's a song that me and my wife would absolutely muller in the car with our hideous, out-of-tune vocal duets. There's a bit in the middle of this song, when your listeners hear it, where he, I know someday you'll have a beautiful life. I know you'll be a star in somebody else's sky, but why can't it be mine? And he carries this my on for an enormously long length of time, this note. And you can imagine me and my wife in the car trying to hold this note for as long as we can. And it was hideous. It was hideous, but we loved the song. And so when we were at Hyde Park, I had it in my head that if they played this song, that's when I would propose. During this bit of the song that we mutilated several, you know, many, many times, and they did play it. I don't know what I would have done if they hadn't have played it, whether I would have picked another song, but they did play it. I proposed. She said yes. She didn't change her mind afterwards. But then looking back at it, and I realised that the actual words of the song are really, really not the kind of words to a song that you want. I did it because of the sentiment of what we used to sing in the car and how we loved the song. But when you look back, I know someday you'll have a beautiful life. I know you'll be a star in somebody else's sky, but why can't it be mine? Will you marry me? it's not really how you want to start a, you know, a life together, is it? But you know, you pick these moments, and you die by you know landing on your own sword sometimes, don't you? If that's the right saying, and this is one of their you'd class it as almost as a power ballad, maybe. but it's a great song. Ooh, and all I taught her was everything.
Black there by Pearl Jam, and a special track for you and your wife, Chris. Now we are going to come back to university time for you, Chris, and a move from Liverpool down to the south and the leafy area of Surrey. What made you want to make that move from Liverpool down south to university?
I didn't want to do it. That's the bottom line. I found it very daunting, that the idea of being, not being able to see properly, rattling around in this huge place full of strangers in a place I didn't know, it terrified me. And I wasn't going to do it. I wasn't even going to apply to university. I was going to go back to Liverpool. I was at RNC at the time, and there was a teacher there, a lecturer called Tim Ashmore, who was my maths lecturer, and possibly at one point my form like leader, if that's what you'd call them. I can't remember. He might have been. If he wasn't, he certainly took that mantle on. He was a massive influence on me. I think when you look back and you kind of think of you, is there one teacher from your past that kind of had the biggest influence or effect on you? It would have been Tim. I'd like to tell him that one day. But he persuaded me to apply to university. If you don't want to go, just do me a favor. Just apply to them and just see if you get accepted anywhere. So I applied to six of them. I ended up applying to Kingston because it turns out that somebody I knew from the college had gone there the year before. So I thought, well, at least I'll know someone there. And I went down and had the meeting with the people, and I spoke to the lad I knew who was already down there. And in the end, I decided to give it a go. And my best mate, who I've grown up with in Liverpool since I was three, he decided that he was going to go to university as well. And he was going to go up to Sunderland or Middlesbrough or something. And I said to him, oh, well, I've just been offered a place at Kingston. Why don't you apply there and come there? And he went, yeah, okay then. Such was the level of our research. So he phoned them up and just said, can I apply? Can I come and have a, you know, I think the application process had kind of passed. And they went, yeah. And so we ended up coming down together. So the two Scousers went down to Kingston together, and that alleviated a lot of the stresses for me. And I was in halls for the first year and met a group of friends who are still my closest friends to this day. It was the best decision I ever made. I don't do anything in life now that in any way comes from what I'm qualified in. I got a 2.2 in software engineering, but the achievement of doing it and the experience of going and meeting, you know, people who are still my closest friends, and it put me in London on the outskirts of, and giving me, I suppose, I wouldn't say opportunity, because you've got opportunity everywhere, but almost kind of putting me on the path I've ended up, in terms of, I wouldn't have met the people I've met, I wouldn't have probably started comedy, I wouldn't have met my wife, you know, all of these things all probably stem from Tim Ashmore persuading me that I should go to university and not just go back to Liverpool and hope something happens. And when I was at university, you're exposed suddenly, almost like I was at Worcester with the older kids, but you're exposed to adults now who have all come from different walks of life with all of their own musical tastes. When I was growing up in Liverpool and you know, in the 90s, and I was into this kind of American grunge music, that's really just what I stuck to. I just liked rock music. I went to a rock club. We went and watched, you know, to festivals and things like that. But at university, you meet other people who've got their own favourite types of music. And this next song is by a band called Dave Matthews Band. I'd never heard of them. And they are humongous. If you've never heard of them, they are astronomically humongous. They play outdoor Central Park shows, like in America and the south side of the equator. They are one of the biggest bands that exists touring to this day, but yet remarkably unheard of over here. And I think it's probably just because their records don't get played on the radio. But when they do play over here, there is like a hardcore fan base that can fill the O2 or fill an arena. But they are almost like a cross between, I think they're counted as a jam band, but they're almost like an acoustic / electric jazz rock ensemble with clarinets and violins and guitars and a drummer who's got 4,000 drums in front of him. I don't know how he manages to hit them all. They're an astonishing thing to listen to live. And I remember dancing all night watching them at Shepherd's Bush Empire. And this is off an album called Crash. And not only is it a great song, not only is it quirky, but I think it also probably encapsulates my university years. It's about excess. So
Well, I think we better play the track and leave that there then.
It's called Too Much.
Too Much Fair by the Dave Matthews Band, and maybe a play out on Connect Radio might boost their following too, perhaps. We now come to a track from a band that you discovered during the first lockdown, when you, like many other performers and artists, had perhaps a bit more time on your hands due to all the lockdowns and COVID and everything else. What was lockdown like for you as a comedian and performer? You know, what were those days like? Because it must have been awful. It must have been sort of not being able to gig must have been terrible.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a double-edged kind of sword. It feels horrible to say that looking back, I probably appreciate having that opportunity to kind of have some time off, because people have gone through horrible things, you know, but I've never given myself time off. In 19 years of stand-up, I have never taken time off to kind of off from gigging. And I think it was well needed. When you're self-employed, you can't just not work. You can't, it's like, because you're not getting paid. You know, it's almost like I'm not just shoveling money out the window to not work. So I've never taken time off. And then this lockdown came around and I did have a lot of work on. So I had a lot of work on for TV and things like that. But it was nice to have that mental mental break from gigging. And I used the opportunity. I thought, you know what? I haven't got into new music in so long. I've been listening to the same albums for the last 20 years. And I thought, you know what? I'm gonna pretend I'm 20 years old again. And I'm going to go out and find some new music and some new bands and really rediscover the love of discovering new music. And I did. And I think this song is by a band called I Like Trains. Not only is that a quite an obscure, cool name, but I'd never heard of them. And this album by this band called I Like Trains, not only is it English, not only is it, I'd never heard of them, it's a style of music I wouldn't have touched with a barge pole. And I loved it. It's almost like a spoken word, synth-laden rock band of... the whole album seems to be pieced together but with almost sayings and metaphors and truisms and... And I'm sure on a kind of a linguistic level, if you kind of work your way through all the lyrics, it probably means nothing, but it sounds like it means everything. It's a bizarre album, and I loved it. And I think this album represents everything that I got out of lockdown on a personal level in terms of rediscovering music. I Like Trains.
I Like Trains there, and A Steady Hand, and maybe there's a meaning in that title for everyone here. Chris, we now come to your final track, the one that you might like to pass on to others that maybe might give people hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Well, I'm going to go against convention here, and I'm going to say what the track is that I was going to choose, first of all, if that's okay. I was going to choose a song called Uncle Sam Goddamn by an American rap artist called Brother Ali, but there is no way it would have passed your censorship. And the reason I was going to choose that is because I do like a bit of hip-hop, and I got into this rapper, and I just urge people to look him up. That's why I'm saying it, because I got into him, and I just loved the funkiness and the politicism and the passion of the music. And then I discovered, after I'd listened to about three albums, that this guy's an albino and he's registered blind. And he's just one of the most highly respected American rap artists currently working today. And I was gonna pick that because it represents that even though you've got a disability, you can achieve and perform in the mainstream. And I just love everything that that stands for. However, the language is atrocious. So I've gone from something from the children's musical, The Greatest Showman. And the reason I've gone for this is also, I think, just as meaningful. First of all, This Is Me from The Greatest Showman, Kiala Settle. It's first of all a lovely song with a great message and a great sentiment, but it also represents, first of all, me and my daughter enjoying music together, enjoying watching things together. She loves this film, she loves the album, she sings all the songs. But I was lucky enough to do the Royal Variety performance this Christmas just gone at the Royal Albert Hall, and Kiala Settle was on the bill, and I was told she was going to be doing this song. And I, out of everybody on the bill, I was so excited, because my daughter doesn't really get to watch a lot of what I do because she's 8 and it's all a little bit grown up. But I got to tell her that I was going to be on a show with the lady from The Greatest Showman, and look forward to watching this on the TV with me daughter. And I was there the day before the filming to do the rehearsals and the run through and everything. And I was lucky enough to sit in a room in an empty Royal Albert Hall and watch this phenomenal lady belt out this song with a choir, with drums around the outside of the Albert Hall. I've been to watch lots of bands over the years, and I think this was one of the most phenomenal things I've ever been lucky enough to sit in a room and watch, and especially in an empty Royal Albert Hall. It'll stick with me forever. And so that experience, it represents where I'm up to with my comedy in terms of getting to play the Royal Albert Hall. It represents what I get to enjoy with my daughter and being able to watch it with her. It's a wonderful positive message in the song, and it represents that I love being proven wrong. And, you know, I was always very dismissive. Yeah, just musicals, it's a little bit kind of, you know, up itself, isn't it? But it slapped me in the face and it told me to shut up and listen.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Chris McCausland, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Toby, thank you very much. It's been lovely. Cheers.
I'm gonna send a blood, gonna drown a man. This is brave, this is bruised, this is who I'm meant to be, this is me.